Ladies and gentlemen, this should be a chorus of 9 voices welcoming you here. I believe that's a record in the South Asia Department. I can't speak for my other colleagues. I'm going to let Steve start the welcoming process and me finish it up, and then we will go on to the program as planned, but we are delighted to see you all here.
Thank you, Tazi, Ambassador Schaefer. We're not gathered here at a memorial in the conventional sense. We meet here to honor one dimension of Khaled Hassan, his career as a journalist and reporter. He had other careers. As an author, as a government official, he was Zulfikar Ali Bhutto's press secretary, and as a translator, especially of the works of Fies and Manto. And I would add, as a humorist, read his letters from Washington for this side of Khaled. I don't know if Ambassador Boucher is here, but he certainly was mentioned in those dispatches quite frequently. Those of us who have spontaneously come together for this panel knew Khaled's repertorial side, and we all agree that one word sums up his role as a journalist: integrity. We were on the receiving end of his comments and questions, but he never betrayed a confidence, and while there were times where he must have disagreed with what we were saying and writing, but he did not allow his own views to distort his role as a professional journalist. This was something Khaled felt very strongly about, and in one of his very last columns, he took a position that was unpopular in Pakistan. And I'll quote, this is about the case of the Iraqi journalist who threw the shoe at President Bush, which seems funny, but Khaled saw the other side of it. Quote, as a journalist, I have reservations about the Iraqi journalist's action. A working journalist is permitted close physical proximity to presidents and prime ministers in order for him to perform his professional duties. He must not abuse that privilege or employ it to push his personal or political agenda. Therefore, regardless of what al-Zaidi or the rest of us think of President Bush and his policies, what the man did was wrong. He abused and betrayed the trust that had been placed in him. Journalists should use their pens and their cameras, not their shoe, to express themselves, unquote. I think that expresses Khaled's perspective very well. Guy of great integrity, great perception, and at first these panels were planned as a small gathering of a few people. There was a spontaneous interest in honoring Khaled, and with no precedent in this town, 9 institutions have come together to co-sponsor this event. And there are a few others which we may have left out. In fact, I know there are a couple who have asked to participate, but we simply couldn't move quickly enough. We come together out of our shared respect for Khaled Hassan and his work and because of the importance of Pakistan. I only wish that you were here sitting, perhaps over there, in the front row, pen in hand, with questions ready to cover this event. Perhaps she can see us from another place and will write a suitably wry and perceptive column for a different readership. Our thanks to CSIS for making the space available, to all of the other programs for coming together on this occasion.
I was in Pakistan when we got word that Khaled was very ill and then that he had died. The outpouring of affection and regard among the people we were seeing in Lahore was really striking. He leaves a big hole in the South Asia watching community in Washington, and I'm sure beyond that. The idea for this afternoon, however, was to show our respect for this man whom we knew as a journalist and in that sense as a colleague by reflecting on the subject nearest and dearest to his heart, which is Pakistan, the dream that is Pakistan, what's happening to it now, and what might be happening in the future. And so that is what I would like to introduce. We have put together 2 panels, which is why you see this excessively large number of people up here. We're actually not all going to talk at you at once. The first panel focuses on the current situation and will be moderated by Lisa Curtis of the Heritage Foundation. I will leave it to her to introduce her colleagues. I will moderate the second one, which is reflections on Pakistan's future. We will have brief presentations at the beginning of each panel. We will take questions at the end of each panel, but we'll call time fairly sharp between the first and the second panels because we've got the larger number of people on the second panel. and our aim is to conclude by 4:45. We are, as I said before, delighted that so many people have turned out because I think having us think together about this very important country that is going through a very difficult time is probably the greatest tribute we could bring to someone whom everyone in this room loved and respected. So, Lisa, let me turn the proceedings over to you.
Okay. Thank you, Tazy, Steve. Thanks to CSIS for hosting this and to all my colleagues here for participating. Most of us who knew Khalid were deeply shocked by the news of his passing. Khalid had assiduously kept track of everything that happened in Washington relating to Pakistan. He attended almost every event related to Pakistan, and he wrote on every possible angle of U.S. policy toward Pakistan. That's why we decided that the best way to honor his memory was to hold an event that he himself would have relished attending. The last time I saw Khalid was, in fact, in this room on December 11th, 2 short months ago. I was speaking at an event on India-Pakistan relations, and Khalid was sitting there, as usual, in the front row, and it didn't surprise me that Khalid asked one of the first questions from the audience, and needless to say, it was not an easy question. In fact, you could always count on Khalid to put you on the spot by asking the most provocative and difficult questions. He never threw softballs. And that's probably why his reporting was so good and was read by so many. So today we will follow the high standards that Khalid has set for all of us in continuing to search for the answers to the most difficult questions on Pakistan and South Asia more generally, because there certainly are many. Let us remain committed to this task, to honor our dear friend Khalid, who himself never stopped searching for answers. Pakistan faces incredible challenges, ranging from an economic crisis that threatens to bankrupt the country, an increased threat from Taliban forces in its northwest frontier province and tribal border areas, and an ongoing political instability fueled by the reality that the military retains primary control of the country's national security decision-making and on those issues of prime importance to the U.S., namely policy toward Afghanistan and India. The Obama administration is reviewing its strategies in Afghanistan and Pakistan, displaying a welcome recognition that the terrorist threats in these two countries cannot be viewed in isolation. There's been particular focus on the SWAT agreement, and I just want to say on this agreement, we all want peace and reconciliation in Pakistan, but neither do we want to see Talibanization of Pakistan. And there are valid reasons to believe that this deal could contribute to strengthening the Taliban's hand in Pakistan. Here with us today to talk more about these challenges are two friends and distinguished colleagues who care deeply about the region and who travel there quite frequently. Dr. Steve Cohen, who I'm sure most everybody in the room already knows, is senior fellow at the Brookings Institute, and he's been there since 1998. He previously was professor of political science and history and founder and director of the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security at the University of Illinois Urbana. He was also a member of the policy planning staff at the U.S. Department of State from 1985 to 1987, as well as a scholar in residence for the Ford Foundation in New Delhi. He took his first trip to Pakistan in 1977 and is well known for his expertise on the Pakistan military, having authored the famous book, The Pakistan Army. And I have to mention, as a junior political officer arriving at post in Pakistan in 1994, this book was of great use to me. So that I met Steve through his book. His most recent book, The Idea of Pakistan, has also received wide acclaim and is a must-read for all students of Pakistan. Alex Thier has been going to Pakistan and Afghanistan since 1993, and he's lived in Peshawar, Quetta and Islamabad. He is editor of the recent book, The Future of Afghanistan, and was also a member of the Pakistan Policy Working Group, as well as some of the others on the panel. And want to point out that Alex was one of the primary drafters of that report, and we appreciated very much having his perspective. And also, both Steve and Alex and Bob were involved in the grueling 4 to 5 hour session, I think, and Marv as well, in trying to come up with a consensus on the report's findings, which, of course, is not an easy thing to do when you have 13 Pakistan experts, most of whom have spent the majority of their careers following the region. So thank everyone for their participation in that effort. Alex is now at USIP. He's their senior advisor in the Rule of Law Center of Innovation. He is also the director of the Project on Constitution Making, Peace Building, and National Reconciliation. He's the expert group leader for the Genocide Prevention Task Force and director of the Future of Afghanistan Project. He's also responsible for several rule of law programs inside Afghanistan, including a project on establishing relations between Afghanistan's formal and informal justice systems. So without further ado, I'd like to hand the floor over to Steve.
Thank you, Lisa. When I was in the State Department for two unfortunate years in 1985-87, I was a Democrat in a Republican administration, but I still learned something. I don't know what I contributed. When people would come and talk to me about Pakistan, especially about the nuclear program, I had on my desk a little souvenir that I picked up in India, and, you know, Teen Bandar. Those of you who've been to South Asia know what it is, the three monkeys. And there was this little carving, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. And when they'd ask me, especially when friends would ask me, what's going on in Pakistan? I'd point to my Teen Bandar, my three monkeys. And clearly the United States at that time, I was part of the process, I can't be critical, really when it came to Pakistan's critical problems domestically in particular, including the nuclear program, looked the other way. And from an American point of view, I can see the larger framework of that, and it was necessary, justified, and so forth. But it did have consequences, as did the war in Afghanistan for Pakistan. Fast forward 2003, I'm finishing a book on Pakistan, the future of Pakistan. And the last sentence in the book, if I can recite it by memory, which I've been doing frequently, is the United States may have one last opportunity to get Pakistan right, lest it become the kind of evil, malign state that people accuse it of being. And I thought then that if the Bush administration moved quickly, in a sense, they could do a lot to help Pakistan and help ourselves in the long run. Because for the first time, I must confess, when I wrote the Pakistan Army book, I didn't know much about Pakistan domestic politics. But I taught myself as much as I could and borrowed a lot from friends. And I think that for the first time, I understood how important developments in Pakistan themselves were for America. And unfortunately, I think we saw a couple of wasted years, many wasted years in the Bush administration, where essentially American policy was devolved on one person, Pervez Musharraf, who I never felt was really up to the task of being even an Ayub Khan. So I think that we're in a position now where the question that I raised in the last sentence of the book, and actually the whole book, was, is it too late for Pakistan? And I can't really give you an answer for that. In a sense, the book tried to look at Pakistan's futures, looked at 5 or 6 possible futures for Pakistan. And to myself, I had percentages of likelihood. Unfortunately, they added up to more than 100%. So Pakistan could have been a radical Islamist state, which I don't think is going to happen, although parts of Pakistan seem to be turning into radical Islamist sub-state. It could have been a democracy, which I don't see a functioning, balanced democracy, which I don't see happening, although parts of Pakistan certainly are very democratic or governed by democratic norms and values. It could have been it could become a military dictatorship again, but which I'd say is more likely than not. But still, even under the military, in some cases, even under Musharraf, it was a benign kind of military leadership, incompetent but benign. Or it could continue on as it has been, that is sort of a establishment-dominated, elite-dominated coalition of military and political. And I thought when I wrote the book, and I published the book, wrote it in 2003, published 2004, so that's 50% likely future. But I would say that may be less now. That is, the possibility of Pakistan continuing in the future as a stable, benevolent aristocracy, or, you know, establishment-dominated country, is probably less than I thought than it would have been, you know, 5 or 8 years ago. And I think a number of things have happened to, in a sense, make me more alarmed about Pakistan. And the book, in fact, concluded with a series of alert or warning alarms, and all of them were blinking red in 2 years. I knew that, you know, Pakistan was headed in a different direction than I'd hoped it would. Clearly, the economy is the central feature of this. The economy under Musharraf did not prosper, and Pakistan is uniquely ill-equipped to cope with modernist globalization. I won't go into the details, but the educational system failed to adapt to globalization. The policies pursued under the Musharraf government and earlier governments were dysfunctional. So I think that unless you have a strong, vibrant economy, a lot of other possibilities for future, including democracy, are not that likely. My next book is going to be on this. I won't tell you everything I know right now. I actually should do some research before coming to some conclusion. So I think that so the prospect of a semi elitist, aristocratic establishment dominated Pakistan may be somewhat reduced. Will the military take over again? Probably. In a sense, if things get to be a critical moment, you'll see the army come back in, but it won't necessarily be effective. And as I tell my military friends, you know how to. You don't want others to govern most of the time, but you can't govern yourself. Clearly, if the military transformed itself into a governing kind of force, you'd see a Pakistan ruled by the military effectively. But the army is faced with at least three security problems. One is India. One, of course, is the frontier in Fatah. And the third is domestic, in a sense. The growing radicalism in Punjab presents a security crisis for the army itself. So I see that potentially the military might come back to rule in Pakistan, but that's certainly not a solution. Will Pakistan become an Islamist Pakistan? Again, as I said, maybe some parts of it already have, but I don't see this spreading throughout the country. So I see the future is indeterminate. And this, of course, the one bright spot, two bright spots I see, really, is the rise of NGO and civic society. Young Pakistanis, lawyers, professionals are really clued into the global movement towards, if not democratization, at least liberalization. And secondly, there's a new factor in that every one of Pakistan's neighbors, including India, do not want to see the worst happen to Pakistan. And I think there's an opening here for diplomacy, for strategy. The Americans, the Chinese, the Afghans, certainly, even the Saudis and the Indians all want to see Pakistan emerge out of its prolonged crisis, a crisis that's going to go on for years, perhaps, as a reasonably stable state. And I think the trick of American diplomacy will be to, in a sense, align these other countries behind a policy which promotes, I won't say democracy because I don't see the Chinese or the Saudis interested in democracy, but at least stability and certainly economic growth in this scenario where the Chinese could make a big difference. And, of course, the rise of civil society is important in Pakistan. But really, in the end, it's up to Pakistanis themselves to ask themselves, what kind of country do we want to have? And the last book I wrote on Pakistan was about the idea of Pakistan. And it really was a series of contested ideas, arguments between the army and the Islamists, those people in liberal Pakistanis, and, of course, the regional separatists. And I'm not sure where this is headed, but I think that for the first time in its history, everybody is rooting for Pakistan to do better. And presumably, hopefully, everybody will help Pakistan in this mission. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. Now we'll have Alex.
Thanks so much. It's an honor to be speaking with all of you and to all of you. There are many people, I think probably just about everybody on this dais and half of the audience, who have forgotten more about Pakistan than I will ever know. By way of saying that, I will maybe retreat to the refuge of anecdote and quotation. To follow up on Steve, I just got off the plane from Kabul, and I got in on Monday. And this week for me marks 16 years, almost to the week, that I first flew to Peshawar, Pakistan, with a one-month tourist visa and the hopes of working between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Benazir Bhutto was campaigning at the time to regain her seat as prime minister. The much hoped-for outflow of millions of Afghan refugees who had sought refuge during the Soviet war had not begun. And indeed, much to the chagrin of many of the people in Pakistan, the outflow of refugees almost began to increase as the civil war in Afghanistan began. The Pakistani government, I think unbeknownst to many people who hadn't been paying attention, began an effort to oust not only the Afghans — they did place some pressure — but particularly on the so-called Afghan Arabs. This was a time in late 2002 and early late 1992, early 1993, when the government of Pakistan began to realize some of the dangers, I think, that their policies, together with the United States and others in the region, the dangers that those policies held for Pakistan in terms of not only the support for the Afghan jihad, but support for jihad overall. And the potential price that whirlwind would reap in Pakistan and in the region. On the 1st of February of 1993, four UN officials were killed in UN vehicles that had just traveled from Pakistan into eastern Afghanistan. And the reason I cite that is because I think it's one of the very first incidents. It was later believed to have been committed by Afghan Arabs who were opposed to the idea of the UN moving into Afghanistan and helping to reclaim, having Afghanistan reclaim its place in the international community. Fortunately for them, it didn't happen, but this was one of the first attacks in memory that was really, I think, the start of sort of that next phase of what Al-Qaeda would become. So over this last 16 years, watching the evolution of the frontier has been the sad preoccupation of many of those like Khalid who have been the scribes of Pakistan's recent history. For many of us, particularly in that era, the journalists of Pakistan were really the lifeline of information in the years when the frontier and Pakistan overall was not among all of the news that was fit to print. There was very little Western journalism paying attention, I think, to the evolution of what was happening either in Afghanistan or in Pakistan in that period. And those of us who were there or who were interested in following it routinely had to rely particularly on the Pakistani journalists, Khalid among them, who were the most intrepid in sort of laying out the story on both sides, both in the U.S. as well as in Pakistan itself. And going back and looking at Khalid's work, you know, he was, like many Pakistani journalists, I think, were erudite, humorous, tolerant, moderate. And in many ways, these are the voices that at least people like me learned about Pakistan from, both publicly and privately. For instance, Khalid wrote a few years ago, there was a bill that was put before the Northwest Frontier Province Parliament in the earlier incarnation of the effort to pass Sharia in the Northwest Frontier. And he wrote about this bill in the NWFP assembly: for the second time was a slap in the face of the vast majority of the people of Pakistan who abhor the mullah's Islam, which is a travesty of Islam's inner spirit of rationalism, decency, and tolerance. And it's striking to me over and over about how that perspective is one that so many of the Pakistanis that I've come to know have shared. And so trying to square the circle of this view of Pakistan and the realities that are consuming parts of Pakistan has been, I think, an interesting and difficult exercise. But I also wanted to comment. I had seen this quote, and Steve had mentioned, you know, the humor with which he often wrote, again, on these subjects. And I think that it speaks to the way that many Pakistanis have dealt with the challenges imposed by the transition, at least of parts of the country, into intolerance, and attacking that not only with strong words but with humor. He wrote, the MMA, this was from a friend of his, and wrote, the MMA is also determined to end vulgarity and obscenity on PTV. I would suggest it go a step further and end PTV itself, since, along with Radio Pakistan, PTV makes up the twin otters of dullness and disinformation. And then he went on to write, the pure ones also want to abolish co-education once and for all. Why don't they go ahead and abolish women themselves? Because the female of the species it is that appears to bother them the most. And so I just wanted to transition from that briefly into the situation in Pakistan at the moment. I think that we are all deeply troubled by the combination of political fragmentation and radicalization that is occurring in Pakistan. I think the story of the political fragmentation is an old one, and in some ways, unfortunately, has contributed over and over again to this pendulum swing between attempts at democracy and authoritarianism, which has consumed Pakistan for all of its history. But I think that we're seeing a period which seems especially dangerous, because the degree of radicalization, which I think previously had sometimes been used, primarily the provenance of military leaders like Zia, to inflame the population towards some idea of Pakistan, some sort of nationalism that would allow them to do what they wanted to do. But I think what we see now and in reality is that the Pakistani establishment and the military establishment no longer has control over this rhetoric, which is a far more dangerous place. This is, I think, largely due to the fact, and particularly what I know best is the frontier area, that there is simply no outlet for politics. And I think in all places where we see no outlet for politics, no possibilities for participation, no possibilities for the youth bulge to participate actively in the economy, in the development of Pakistan, it creates an enormous potential for people to support political movements which take advantage of their frustration and their idleness. And that's clearly what's happening in the frontier now. I know that from the U.S. perspective, as we've all heard over and over again, Pakistan has become the most dangerous nation. This combination of loose nukes, or the threat of loose nukes, jihadists, and economic meltdown pushes all of our primary buttons at the moment. Those are our three greatest concerns, probably, if you were to prioritize them. And Pakistan seems at the moment the embodiment of all of those fears. I know from very good sources and more than one source that President Obama has been briefed extensively on Pakistan. And to paraphrase, I think it scared the bejesus out of him. That there is an enormous amount of concern about Pakistan should not surprise people. But I think that the question that we have to confront right now is that Pakistan presents an enormous conundrum for the United States on how we can be effective in addressing these fears. So far, the debate, I fear, has been somewhat binary. It's the sort of kill or capitulate debate that I think is embodied in the peace agreements in SWAT and in other areas, or in the debate over the use of drones to attack militants. We seem to feel as though our hands are tied, and the Pakistani government seems to feel as though its hands are tied, that we either strike out with violence or that we capitulate to those who would consume Pakistan, Afghanistan, the region, and strike again at the United States. And I obviously neither of those are acceptable options, and yet that seems to be a little bit where the debate is mired. And I think that the one bringing this discussion full circle, the one obvious and most important element of this debate and how we will ultimately get past these challenges comes back to engaging Pakistani society. From a human perspective, as someone who's traveled to most corners of Pakistan, mostly just as a tourist or a traveler in many of the places, I've never been to a place in Pakistan that I didn't like, that I was warmly received, that I didn't find fascinating, and that I didn't enjoy the people. And this is as an American, even as a Jew, although I didn't always proclaim that to be the case, but often did, and it didn't make a difference. Because at a human level, Pakistani society, I think, is a fundamentally tolerant society. There are some seasons in Pakistan that I prefer to avoid, but not many people. And I think that the final element of this is the media, bringing this back to Khalid. One of the great things that I think that we've seen in Pakistan in the last couple of years is the incredible explosion of the free media. And the impact that that has on informing Pakistani society and allowing them to engage directly themselves in this debate. Because until this question of Pakistan's future and what's happening now becomes fundamentally a Pakistani question and not one that they feel they're responding to because of external pressures, because of the United States or because of India, but becomes fundamentally a Pakistani question, then it's never going to succeed in being resolved. And I think in many ways that is the legacy of Khalid and the media overall in Pakistan, the brave media that is making Pakistan's people party to this process and hopefully will make them the engine of reform ultimately in Pakistan.
Thank you very much, Alex. I'm going to take the prerogative of being the chair to ask the first question. And I would like to ask the panelists for their comments on the Swat Valley Agreement. And where I obviously am extremely skeptical about this agreement, and that's based on a lot of reasons, one of which is my history and experience with the region and the Taliban. When I arrived at post in Pakistan in September of 1994, within 1 to 2 weeks, I think the Taliban rolled into Kandahar, being led by Nasirullah Babar, who was the interior minister for then Prime Minister Bhutto. And it was a new phenomenon. Nobody saw it coming. Everybody was trying to play catch up and figure out who they were, what they were all about. And there was pretty much confusion, I can say, among U.S. policymakers about what was happening. But I really take issue when people say the U.S. supported the Taliban in the 1990s. Well, the U.S. did not support the Taliban. The U.S. was not sure what to make of the Taliban. And the Taliban evolved as they took power. And they became increasingly extremist and fundamentalist in their policies and repressive toward women, and used sort of repression of women as a tool to consolidate their power. And it's the same thing we see happening in the Swat Valley, frankly. And that is the basis of my concern for what we see. And I think also basis of my concern is a recent visit I made to Pakistan in December, just last December. And I met with residents of the region of the Northwest Frontier Province and of Swat Valley in particular. And what I heard was people who were scared. They felt helpless. They lamented the fact that the Pakistan government had no strategy to deal with what was happening in the region, yet the extremists seemed very clear on their agenda and what they were trying to push. So I see the agreement, yes, as a capitulation, which may sound stark considering the challenges there. But I think, you know, we have to be concerned when we look at, you know, what's been happening over the last 2 years. And the fact that the government has not shown that it has a strategy to deal with this problem. So, I made my own comment here, but I would like to hear from our panelists their thoughts.
Thank you, Lisa. I don't claim to be an expert on SWAT or the deal. What alarmed me about it when I first heard about it was that it seemed that the government of the Northwest Frontier Province, the Islamabad government, and the army all had different reactions to it. So I hope that they've got their policies in order. I think the deeper issue is that in any area where there's no government, chaos reigns and people demand justice. And if the Taliban can provide justice, they'll accept it. Taliban were, in fact, popular over much of Afghanistan for a while. So I think in the case of SWAT, if the government doesn't govern, if there's no civil order or even a military governor that's effective, you will get groups like this emerging, and Pakistan has been subject to this aspect of globalization, Islamist radical globalization, which has been very destructive to it. So I think that the solution really is, in a sense, to regain fiscal control over the region, both the night and the day, and then, of course, recreate or establish, because it never was there to begin with, an effective civilian government. This is a very tall order, and it's what makes me pessimistic about the future of these parts of Pakistan. On the other hand, from an American point of view, I think there's two interests in Pakistan. One is that it's not be a base for Islamist extremism, which could reach out and hit us in one way or the other. And secondly, that the integrity of Pakistan is an interest of America, as it is of India and China and other states, because Pakistan is a nuclear weapon state. So Pakistan strategically is important because of its weakness, where historically it was important because of its strength. There's a paradox and which we have to understand, but clearly this is a country that we cannot leave alone.
On my way to Kabul, I stopped in Dubai for a conference for about 4 days on constitutions in the Muslim world. And the fundamental question that comes up when you examine the history of constitutionalism in the Muslim world is always the question of who's Islam. And I think one of the things that fundamentally concerns me about the idea of the SWAT deal and the idea of calling the law that's supposed to rule in SWAT Sharia is that it is part of a broader definitional battle that's happened for years in Pakistan and is happening all over the Muslim world about what the content and meaning of Islam is, and perhaps more importantly, who gets to decide that. And insofar as this sort of agreement is an acknowledgement of the government of Pakistan that somehow what rules Pakistan is not Islamic, is not Sharia, and that you need special mullahs in with obscurant interpretations of Islam to declare what Sharia really means, and that any other standard of a central government won't be sufficient, is a very dangerous road to travel, I think, for the Muslim world overall. Because it really hands this extremely powerful definitional battle to those who would use it for extremist political purposes. And so not to contradict what Steve was saying, to agree with it, but just to add to that, one of my primary concerns is about this larger battle, both within Pakistan and in the region, for who gets to decide what Islam is and therefore to impose their will upon the rest of the population.
Great. Thank you so much. And we'll take questions from the audience. I just ask that you wait for the microphone and then state your name and affiliation. Okay.
Thank you, Liz. Raghuveer Goyal from India Global Asia Today. First of all, really, I pay my tribute to Khalid Hassan. It came to me as a surprise. It was a good friend, and I could always rely on him any time to call him. And he was a friend to everybody. The quick question is that since this 60-day review is going on by the Obama administration, they have been meeting the delegation from Pakistan, Afghanistan. They are now here at the State Department with Senator Hillary Clinton and all that. What do you think that we see any difference between the last 8 years of Bush administration, which Fatah and the problems in Pakistan and all that terrorism, Al-Qaeda, and all going on since last 8 years? What would be different, or what do you think the Obama administration can do different than what Bush didn't do?
Well, I think that, good question. I think that the Bush administration focused on the first issue I talked about, that is Islamic extremism. And it used a military instrument which in some cases was appropriate, that is the Predators do have minimal collateral damage. They may offend Pakistani sensibilities, but they are in fact effective in killing the right people and not killing the wrong people most of the time. Of course, no military instrument is perfect. But I think that they paid little, if any, attention to the second issue, that is the future of Pakistan itself. And that was seen as a problem they could deal with in the future. I know when I was in the Reagan administration, we were worried about the next year. Actually, Schultz once told us, like in three weeks, we're the policy planning staff looking ahead. He said, look ahead 3 weeks. We were looking ahead 2 months, and we thought that was pretty long term. So the perspective of a government is, what's going to happen tomorrow? What do I have to do today to affect what's going to happen tomorrow? So they're driven by, both administrations are driven by, the fear of a terrorist attack from that region, Pakistan, Afghanistan area. I think, but the Bush people were particularly uninterested in, if they were aware of it at all, and I think this starts at the top, of Pakistan's long-term survival and future. Whereas the Obama people I know are very concerned about this, and the Biden-Lugar bill now, I guess it's the Kerry-Lugar bill, really addresses this issue. That is, addresses the integrity of Pakistan, the stability of Pakistan, the development of Pakistan. It has economic and military components, and it would transform the rules of the game that under which we deal with Pakistan in the long term. But it won't take effect for a while. In the meantime, the Obama administration is very concerned about short-term consequences.
Elisa, my question is that USA has always taken a position and repeatedly said they want to consolidate democracy and they want to perpetuate the democratic process in Pakistan. But these drone attacks, every time when they are done, the political establishment feel embarrassed, they are on the defensive, they have an image problem, and the resentment increases, and number of extremists also increases. Pakistan has an air force, a ground force, and naval force, and now they have a task force which has come to Washington now. Do you think there's a possibility of review of this approach, or do you think when it undermines the democratic process and the democracy itself, how far it is helpful?
I think that we all hope that there will be a review of the policy. One of the things that I find very difficult about this issue in particular is that there's obviously intelligence that I'm not privy to that goes into the making of these decisions about how important this policy is. You know, ultimately, are the costs, are the benefits that we get from engaging in these strikes today worth the costs that we all understand it has to our relationship with Pakistan, Pakistani support. And I find it, as an analyst, very difficult to evaluate that because of the intelligence gap. Ultimately, and you saw this a few weeks ago, the intelligence community can come out and say, in fact, the drone strikes have been effective beyond our wildest dreams. We have eliminated the top rank of al-Qaeda in Pakistan. There are active plots against the United States and Europe being made now in Pakistan, and that this policy of airstrikes by Predator is disrupting that and maybe preventing attacks. I don't have the wherewithal to evaluate that. And so it's very difficult, I think, for those of us who aren't read into the intelligence to be able to make a serious judgment as to the benefits. What we see are the costs. What we see are a clear deterioration of support within Pakistan, both for the United States as well as for Pakistan's role in combating extremism on its own soil. I think the ultimate question of whether Pakistan sees this challenge as its own challenge as opposed to an challenge that's imposed on it by somebody else, principally the United States, very much depends on whether Pakistanis will own this struggle as their own. And insofar as the Predator strikes prevent them from doing so, then the cost seems quite high. But at the same time, the cost of terrorist attacks, a serious attack which leads directly back to Pakistan, is also a cost that I wouldn't want to contemplate at the moment. So I think it's a very difficult issue, and without the proper intelligence resources, I find ultimately hard to weigh the balance in that decision.
Thanks.
I talked within the past 6 months or so, I've talked to several officials from the Northwest Frontier Province, officials of different kinds, local officials and so forth, and they all agree that the predators were actually pretty effective. There wasn't much collateral damage. They killed a lot of bad people. They admitted that this was not a good public relations thing for the United States, but in terms of the effectiveness, they weren't upset by them.
And I would just note there was a qualitative difference in the objections from Pakistan when you saw the U.S. ground forces raid in September. That was clearly something that I think Pakistan demonstrated was a clear red line. So I would just note that I think there was a qualitative difference in the kind of objections that we're seeing to the Predator strikes to actually having boots on the ground in Pakistan. I do think that's something that the authorities there highly object to. Who else? Colonel Dutta. Right here. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Howie? Okay, next will be Howie. Sorry about that.
Colonel Dutta, Foreign Policy Association. First of all, I'm missing Khalid Hassan. As a matter of fact, we attended anything to do with Indo-Pakistan relations. About 80% of the events we have attended altogether. And also certain views that we agreed to disagree. But one thing which he was very concerned about is this collaboration of the factions of the Taliban's, which has recently taken place. He was forecasting it, that when the Taliban faction get together, there would be a danger for Pakistan's ruling government. Could you please throw some light on it, on these three factions which under Baitul Masood has got together?
I'm not sure how much light I have to shed, but clearly the fact of a variety of different groups who, for a variety of different reasons, have been engaging in insurgency on both sides of the border for the past few years, I think that there is grave concern that operationally they have become more sophisticated, which we see on a day-to-day basis in terms of the scale of attacks, the use of weaponry from suicide bombers to IEDs to car bombs and truck bombs, is a very worrying sign. I think that one of the greatest concerns is this talk of a Pashtun insurgency, in the sense that individual groups and their grievances may coalesce into something broader, that has more of a stake in society. Because I think what hasn't been the case thus far on either side of the border is that these are groups that are largely funded by outside, driven by agendas that are not the popular agenda. But insofar as their coalescing means the potential for galvanizing deeper support within the population on both sides of the border, I think is the most significant concern. At the same time, someone said to me the other day, which I thought was interesting, which is that the sort of condensation or coalescence of these groups does open up two opportunities. First of all, it's easy to kill leadership if there's more of a hierarchy. And second of all, should there be interest in doing so, there is potential to carry out negotiations. So it may not be all bad, but I think indicates something that enhances the peril of what these groups are trying to do.
I won't add very much, except that like the communist in the good old days, you know, it's going to be hard for these groups to work together. There'll be factionalism, differences in ideology, tribal differences among different kinds of Taliban, even though they're all Pashtun, there's subtribal and other ethnic differences. And secondly, if they do succeed to a moderate degree, for example, if they should, as along the Vietnam model, if they should invade and occupy Peshawar for a day, which I think is where we're heading in the not-too-distant future, because they just about ring Peshawar now, will this galvanize Punjab? Will the Punjabis say, look, we've got a problem here, and figure out how to deal with it, and they deal with it, and they could deal with it by expelling the Pashtuns from Pakistan or by militarily trying to conquer them or some other arrangement. So I think it's going to eventually have a Punjab effect, although Punjab has its own ideological problems, but they're not Pashtun problems. These are Punjabi and sectarian problems.
Thanks for the second chance. I'm Howard Schaefer of Georgetown University. I want to join in the general tributes to Khalid Hassan. One thing that I think bears mentioning is his origin, which was in the Jammu part of Jammu and Kashmir. He belonged to one of those Muslim families which were in effect expelled from the province at the time of partition. As far as I can see, that has never affected his interest in strong India-Pakistan relations. My question is directed at Steve Cohen. When we recently visited India, we found something which is somewhat disturbing and which relates to your comment, your view, which I share, that it's important and useful for all of Pakistan's neighbors to work with us towards the stability of Pakistan. The disturbing thing we found is that among quite sensible Indians, there seems to be the heightening view that perhaps the stability of Pakistan is not in India's interest, and perhaps given the unending problems from that side of the border, it might be better to have Pakistan broken up. And I wondered whether you had picked up any of this and whether you consider it a problem.
I did pick it up. I was in Chennai for a talk right after the event in Mumbai, and there were 3,000 angry IIT graduates there, you know, angry at their own government, and then angry at Pakistan for allowing it to happen, then angry at the U.S. government for allowing Pakistan to allow it to happen. And many of them were calling, these are not politically sophisticated people, they're mostly engineers and techies, but many of them were calling for military attack. And the India Today had a poll which I think 80 or 90% of the readers wanted India to attack Pakistan. Of course, when you remember that Pakistan is a nuclear weapon state, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you quickly look on to other solutions. But I do think that there's an attempt, Indian concern, and a growth of anger, obviously growth of anger in India. But this was exactly the purpose of the attack. One of the goals of the attack, I think, was to make sure that India and Pakistan would not continue down the path of normalization, which is all the more reason to get it back on that path. Secondly, I was at that talk in Chennai. I was sharing a platform with Kishore Mahbubani, the former Singaporean foreign secretary. And Kishore addressed the audience. He said, "You Indians out there," he's of Indian origin, but he said, "You Indians out there, you ought to think of what kind of Pakistan you want in 20 years." And I think the audience took that under advisement, because India has to think what kind of Pakistan it wants to live with over the long term, not tomorrow, not the day after. Does it want to play cricket with Pakistan? Does it want to destroy Pakistan? Does it want to have a nuclear war with Pakistan? What kind of Pakistan does it want to have? And India, in fact, should take the lead in sort of shaping what kind of future Pakistan has. Of all the countries around Pakistan, including the United States, India is probably the most influential of all.
Freelance journalist. I like to share some information which I gleaned from the Pakistani television in Washington. I hope Shuja Nawaz would know that. There are events in Pakistan today very ominous. Pakistan's Punjab government has been dismissed. And a governor's rule for 2 months have been imposed by the president of Pakistan. And the former prime minister of Pakistan, Nawaz Sharif, has accused the president of offering him a deal which he didn't accept, and consequently the dismissal of the Punjab government, which is the, as you know, majority province. Now, it seems that the train, the democratic train, which started about a year ago, has come to a crashing halt. So what do you think that the future of democracy in Pakistan would be under these circumstances?
Read my next book.
The question that you have asked, I think, is very fundamental to the future of Pakistan. But I'm going to broaden it a bit. I think that the fundamental problem that confronts Pakistan today, and the one which more than any other will shape its future, is a crisis of the state. One manifestation of it, which Howie and I heard a great deal about during our just completed trip to Pakistan, was the problem of governance, or more precisely, of lack of governance at the central level. The central government seemed to be viewed all around as composed of people who are good at manipulating politics, but have relatively little interest in the boring day-to-day business of making and implementing policies on the problems that confront the country. Obviously, the news in the past 24 hours answered the question many people were asking: was President Zardari going to destabilize the Punjab government? Technically, this was an action of the courts. There seems to be a very widespread view that the courts were at least egged on by the government. And I think this is a very troublesome decision. I think it has it poses a serious threat, certainly to the democratic credentials of the present government, but more generally to the effort to give democracy deeper roots in the actual governing of Pakistan. So that's the first manifestation of the crisis of the state. The second is civil-military relations. There seems to be a general view, which I share, that the army does not want to be in the business of governing, at least not now, that it prefers to have a civilian government out in front. But this doesn't answer the question, really, of what the relationship is going to be between the military and the civilians. The army still expects to have the upper hand on anything touching national security, and it has not been a smooth process. They have been quite public in the way they have rejected some of the civilian government's decisions. The civilian government has been quite public in taking positions that it was ultimately not able to sustain. This is bad for both. The third manifestation is economic, and this is not unique to this government. It goes back really 30 years. You've had governments that have destroyed institutions and have failed to create jobs, which probably more than anything else is what that economy needs. The fourth manifestation of the crisis of the state, and the one people were talking most consistently about, is what I would refer to as the internal insurgency, SWAT being the classic example. And I'm old enough to remember taking my two toddlers and the ayah up for a weekend vacation in SWAT. This was a different world. That provides a bridge to the second big problem, big chronic problem of Pakistan, which is geography. Geography has brought Pakistan and the United States closer, but has also introduced great strains. The most acute one at the moment is Afghanistan, which is the driver behind U.S. policy in the region at the moment. The one that is closest to the heart of Pakistanis is, of course, India. In my view, the U.S. needs to start looking at the future political and economic health of Pakistan as its central problem in the region, even more so than Afghanistan, although obviously as long as there are troops in Afghanistan, that's going to have a particular acuteness about it. But I don't think you can fix the Afghanistan problem unless Pakistan becomes a better governed place and begins to resolve the problem of the authority of the state. I was supposed to be a moderator. I've given you my 2 cents worth. I'm going to stop short of answering the question, what should the U.S. do, because I'm hoping that my colleagues on the panel will have some answers to that, but there may be opportunities later on for me to chime in on that. Let me say, with respect to the focus of this afternoon, which is on Khalid Hassan's contribution, that I think these are questions that were very close to his heart, and I think we can best honor him by trying to address them. I have three most distinguished colleagues with me on the panel. I'm going to introduce them very briefly so we can have more time to listen to what they have to say. First, Robert Hathaway, currently director of the Asia Program at the Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars. But I knew him first when he was a staffer on the Hill working on South Asia issues with the redoubtable Stephen Solars. And I always knew him as a careful and judicious analyst who understood how U.S. domestic politics and Pakistan intersected in its sometimes uncomfortable ways. Next to him is Marvin Weinbaum, a visiting scholar. I guess he's not visiting anymore. I guess he's come to stay at the Middle East Institute.
Resident scholar.
Resident scholar. And a particular expert on Pakistan and Afghanistan. And I have to confess it, Marvin, we go back even farther. We first met in about 1974 in Pakistan, where Marvin at the time was a Fulbrighter, and we were stationed in the embassy. And our first contact was literally a dramatic one. We were both performing, as was my husband, in an epic production of a Woody Allen drama called Don't Drink the Water. And, well, the rest is probably better told another day, but he's a very dramatic fellow. Finally, to my extreme right, although the extreme right is probably not the right place to put him, is Shuja Nawaz, who had a long and distinguished career working for the World Bank, but abandoned that to write an excellent book on the Pakistan Army and on the history of Pakistan / Army. His late brother had been chief of Army staff, and he is now the director of the new Center for South Asian Studies at the Atlantic Council. And no, Pakistan has not moved to the Atlantic. This is a reflection of interest instead. Let me go down the line and ask Bob Hathaway to start off our discussions.
Well, thanks, Tazy, and thanks to Tazy and CSIS and indeed all my colleagues for putting this together. I have a feeling that Khalid would be gratified when he could see this kind of turnout. It's really a testimony to the affection with which he was held here in Washington, as well as his many contributions to make us a little less ignorant about Pakistan, and perhaps Pakistanis a little bit less ignorant about the United States. Our first two speakers today talked about Pakistan in the present. I'd like to turn our attention to Khalid's adopted country, the United States, and how America might contribute to a less troubled Pakistan in the years ahead. As no doubt you are aware, Khalid cared deeply about his adopted country, and that's why it sometime offended him so mightily. I recall hearing him express with considerable passion his frustration with sources, usually government officials, who didn't have the courtesy to even return his telephone calls. He was frustrated precisely because he expected better from America. Our frequently cavalier approach toward Pakistan also angered him. For all his long experience here in Washington, Khalid never understood how it was that we so often fail to appreciate either Pakistan's importance or its potential. He hated our inability to maintain a consistent focus on Pakistan and deplored the loves me not attitude or the nature of America's approach official relationship with Pakistan, where one day we treated Pakistan as an outcast, and the next day we viewed it as a close ally and friend. And not least, Khalid scorned the Washington-centric thinking, which all too often shapes our approach toward international affairs. He scorned our assumption that the world revolves around American perceptions and American interests and American value judgments. In the few minutes I have here, I want to share with you a couple of thoughts about how the United States might go about building a better, more productive, more sustainable partnership with Pakistan. I do not assume that Khalid would necessarily endorse every one of my suggestions. I would like to think that he would have understood the spirit in which these suggestions are offered, and that he would have endorsed my desire to see the two countries which took up so much of his attention, the United States and Pakistan, to see these move these two countries move beyond the relatively unhappy history which has marked their past ties and toward a better future. So in that spirit, and taking into account the fact that I only have 5 or 6 minutes, I'd like to offer a couple of suggestions for consideration by the new Obama administration as it goes through this policy review and as it thinks about the nature of our relationship with Pakistan. My first suggestion would be along the lines of paying more attention to balancing U.S. objectives for Pakistan. In recent years, we have allowed what I think is an understandable preoccupation, but nonetheless a preoccupation with 9/11 and with punishing those responsible for 9/11. We've allowed that to drive our relationship with Pakistan and to obscure other pressing priorities, priorities such as combating domestic extremism in Pakistan, building strong political institutions there, supporting constitutionalism, the rule of law, creating a sustainable economy, fostering peace throughout the region, et cetera, et cetera. I should add, this is not a fault simply of the previous administration. As long as I've been following Pakistan-American ties, we have seldom gotten this balance correct. Second suggestion I would make is simply to be aware that inaction conveys messages just as forcefully as action. Pakistanis will draw conclusions about Washington's position and Washington's preferences, regardless of whether the White House or the Congress issues strong statements of support or condemnation, whether we waffle on issues, or whether we remain absolutely silent. In the past, we have, through silence or inaction, conveyed the message that so long as Pakistan was responsive to our preoccupation of the day, then we really were prepared to turn a blind eye toward other things that were happening in Pakistan. We have, as a consequence, on more than one occasion, failed to stand up for our friends and people who should be our natural allies in Pakistan. We have, through inaction, encouraged Pakistanis to believe that we care more about their autocrats than about their Democrats. And I would submit going forward that this is not a strategy for building a long-term partnership with Pakistan. The third of my suggestions is that we need to appreciate the fact that if we're serious in our claims that a stable, prosperous Pakistan is in the American interests, then there's nothing we can more usefully do than to help put Pakistanis to work. And in that context, quite possibly the best way to put Pakistanis to work is to give Pakistan duty-free treatment to its clothing and textile and leather industries. Pakistan has a strong textile industry. Household linens earn most of the hard currency Pakistan uses, earns to buy food and energy. These industries are good job creators. One estimate has that each container full of towels puts 500 Pakistani men and women to work. But rather than working with Pakistanis to put more Pakistanis to work, American trade policy actually discriminates against Pakistan. Our tariff penalties on Pakistani towels and shirts and soccer balls are far higher than on tariffs we impose on rich countries, goods from rich countries. In addition, we have exempted most African and Latin American products from tariffs, therefore putting Pakistani products at a disadvantage even against their direct competitors. Ladies and gentlemen, this isn't rocket science. Waiving tariffs, reducing tariffs on towels and shirts and other goods Pakistanis make could provide a big boost for urban employment, for helping Pakistan's government cool some of the social and political tensions in the country, and at the end of the day, I hope, for making it more likely that Pakistani democracy will succeed. I have come to the end of my time, so I will simply leave you with one final recommendation without any amplification. And that is, I think we need to be very modest in our expectations about our own ability to influence events in Pakistan. I hear a lot of talk about American so-called leverage over Pakistan. I'm not persuaded. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. And the baton now passes to Marvin Weinbaum.
Thank you, Tacy. Well, we've already heard enough this afternoon to, in addressing the question about what's Pakistan's future, to see it perhaps in rather grim, in a rather grim way, with a little trepidation here as to what is going to follow. Certainly, all the indicators that we generally look at seem to have turned south. And the near-term prognosis, as I'm suggesting, leaves one with great concern. Now, you've heard a number of these here. I just want to very quickly, especially we've heard mention here the mounting challenge presented by the insurgency and the tribal agencies and the districts of the Northwest Frontier Province. The fear that this is only the beginning of a spreading Talibanization, not just into the rest of the frontier province, but throughout the country. There's deep concern, as we've heard here today, about the economy, and as we know, it's been buffeted by economic developments elsewhere. But we also know that there are basic structural problems in the economy. And we don't see at this point any likelihood that they are going to be subject to reform. And what bothers me particularly is the possibility that the continued deterioration in the economy will unleash popular forces in Pakistan that can threaten the public order. Looking further in the future, there are many people, and this has been alluded here today, many people who question the very integrity of the Pakistani state and whether it can weather the pressures that ethnic and regional cleavages are presenting. The future can leave someone depressed if we particularly look at the quality of political leadership that the Pakistanis have thrown up. The country seems virtually incapable of bringing forth new blood. As we look at the current cast of leaders and potential leaders here, we seem to see the same cast repeated over and over again. Then we worry about India. We've just gone through this period of crisis here following the Mumbai attacks. Now, I think that most people are likely to discount the possibility of full-scale war erupting in the near future. But at the same time, everyone recognizes that what will happen if there is another terrorist attack? Will the kind of rational thinking that has just recently, I think, kept the two countries from going to war, will that continue to be sustained? Khalid Hassan recognized all of these possibilities, and he could forcefully dissect the sources of Pakistan's problems. And though his writing was always tough, it was not cynical. The barbs that he would hurl were almost always tinged with humor. Khalid was basically an idealist, someone with a deep faith in his country, and a faith that this could be corrected with the right leadership and the right policies. Unfortunately, some of us couldn't appreciate another dimension of Khalid unless you were a Urdu speaker. You couldn't know really of how much he loved the language and his renown as a translator. So I want to take just a few remaining moments that I have here to suggest what I think Khalid would have wanted for Pakistan. What are the ingredients that Khalid would have liked to have seen in place? As what he wanted for his country and what he believed it could achieve. To begin with, there was his abiding faith in democracy, nurtured in the politics of the best days of the Bhutto government, that is the Zulfikar Ali Bhutto government, in the 1970s, he was secretary to the prime minister. And he never wavered in his belief that the Pakistani people understood democracy and believed in democratic institutions. I think we can agree. Pakistanis do not have to be taught what democracy is all about. It's their birthright to aspire to it. But they have so often been disappointed with those who have called themselves democratic and been elected to office. And as one looks at the future today, what worries me in particular is, are we now going to see the same cycle repeated as people view their leaders, the current dose of democracy? Will it not again disappoint them? And will they look as they have in the past after a period of time for a man on a white horse to set things right. As one Pakistani put it to me, he said, it's because we Pakistanis know we have such enormous problems. The problems that we face are so formidable that we're always looking for someone to deliver us, someone who's larger than life. And then inevitably, of course, that person fails to meet our expectations, and we turn on them. What that means in the current context, when the principal leader started with such low expectations, I think this leaves us to be less confident in what is coming. It follows from this that Khalid had a strong commitment to democracy, that he has had a strong commitment to democracy, that he abhorred military rule in any form. He resigned from the service of General Zia and remained a powerful critic of the regime and of its most recent reincarnation, the military rule of General Pervez Musharraf. Some of us have taken heart this past year, and we've heard mentioned earlier, of the willingness, it would seem, of the current military chief to pull the military back from involvement in politics. We credited the relatively free election last February to the ISI's detachment from a process which it had in the past unashamedly manipulated. The language of General Kiani has certainly been positive in stating that his desire to follow the lead of the elected government. But looking forward, we have reason, I believe, to feel uneasy with the evidence that Pakistan's mounting crises, as these have intensified, the military seems to be moving more and more toward the center stage, more and more seizing the initiative. If the planned protests next month, and now with the developments today of the institution of governor's rule in the Punjab, and the fact that Nawaz Sharif and his brother have effectively been disenfranchised from leadership, what additional ingredient this is going to add? Let's see if I move quickly here, please. Khalid believed that the people of Pakistan are moderate. Although a deeply spiritual man, he abhorred religious extremism and believed that his fellow citizens would reject the extremists. He saw hypocrisy in the religious parties and in their leadership. And while most of us will continue to believe that the public will follow the mainstream, there's a growing unease, I believe, here as we see the cynicism with their mainstream government. As a Kashmiri, as it's already been mentioned, Khalid felt deeply about his future and was anxious for a solution. But he wanted a solution that benefited the people of Kashmir and did not necessarily meet the needs of the strategic or the national honor and the strategic interests of either Pakistan or India. There's indication that the civilian and military leadership is prepared now for some compromise on soft borders. But as we learned before, they can come pretty close and then face the situation that Musharraf was not in a position to sell it to the people of the country. And aren't we faced with this now? A leadership that is, however right it may be in the direction it wants to take the country, has not cultivated the population sufficiently to have it follow. A free press was dear to Khalid's heart. He applauded the developments in the print and electronic media and had and the pluralistic environment that it had created. He set high standards for integrity and objectivity. By the way, he felt very strongly that the Iraqi journalist who threw his shoe at the president, and he wrote this, and let me just So he abused and betrayed the trust that had been placed in him. Journalists should use their pens and cameras, not their shoes, to express themselves. Now, here's a man who felt quite negatively towards George Bush, but the journalistic profession was what he had in mind. Khalid had his feet planted solidly in the United States, but his heart remained in Pakistan. As such, I'm sure that he was profoundly disturbed by the growing estrangement of the people of Pakistan and the United States. It certainly upset him to observe how suspicious they had become of one another. He was all too aware of the wild conspiracy theories in Pakistan that seemed to pervade attitudes toward the United States from the best educated and the taxiwala. He could not help but to recall how, even while many of his fellow Pakistanis have been disappointed with the relationship, there had been an underlying, through the years, an underlying admiration for Americans, their accomplishments, and particularly their political system. Certainly, for the last number of years, there's been bitterness on the part of Pakistanis about American foreign policy towards Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the Middle East, and deep doubts among Americans about the cooperation that we've received in the strategic partnership, mainly as it deals with counterterrorism. The recent election gave many hope, the recent election in our country, many hope that there could be a change in the climate of opinion in Pakistan, just as the democratic election in Pakistan a year ago raised our expectations. But despite the evidence of an awareness between the leaders of both our countries on the need to reconcile differences, a trust gap appears to be widening. Still, I believe that Khalid would have been hopeful that the common interests of both countries would in the end prevail in their relationship. Before closing now, I thought I might suggest some of the headlines that Khalid would have loved to have seen in his paper, The Daily Times. And perhaps he would have written the accompanying story. Constitution amended and the president stripped of powers. Parliamentary supremacy restored. An independent judiciary established. The People's Party and the Muslim League moved towards meaningful conciliation. The campaign against corruption gains momentum. Pakistan and Afghanistan agree that they face a common enemy in religious extremism and militancy. And he would have taken personal pleasure in seeing the headline, PPP finds new leadership outside the Bhutto family. Such headlines may seem a stretch at the moment, but at least useful to know what a country can aspire to and perhaps what it has to achieve if it's going to have a future as a modern progressive state. Khalid never gave up on Pakistan. For our sake and theirs, neither should we. And it will be a while before those of us in this community here stop looking around for Khalid. He would have been seated somewhere right around there with a little pad and busily making notes on that pad. And you cannot help but wonder how he might have written up today. Thank you.
Thank you, Marvin. We've got one more speaker, and then we will let you applaud everybody. Our final speaker is Shuja Nawaz.
Thank you, Tezi, and I'm honored to have been invited to join this august panel. I'm obviously the new kid on the block in more ways than one, because it's only recently that I was allowed to enter this group of analysts working on the region. And I'm still learning the ropes. I want to begin by speaking for a few minutes about Khalid, and then, since this is a conversation, I want to put down some conversation points when we look at the future of Pakistan. I knew Khalid and came to admire him as a young college student and then as a young member of the Pakistan Television News team in the 60s. when Khalid was one of the most popular and trenchant observers and author of satirical columns on politics of the day for, among other things, my favorite news magazine called Outlook that came out of Karachi. And that set a standard for journalism and commentary in Pakistan that I don't think has been met since. I then came to know him when he was press secretary to President Bhutto, and we were together on the very first overseas visit of President Bhutto to Beijing in January and February 1972. And then we had a common experience of having lived in and worked in Vienna, Austria, where I met Khalid at one point when he was working for OPEC News Agency. For me, he was always a mentor, and I will miss him sorely, because with him gone, who is going to tweak the haughty and the poseurs, and who will challenge the hypocrites on a daily basis? We shared one thing in common, and I'm proud of that, and that is that both of us are optimists, and that we were always optimistic about the possibility of Pakistan. And maybe that should be the book that Steve Cohen should write next. So there's a title for you, Steve. But I will disagree with Steve's last line in the previous book, and that is, and this could be the first line in the next book, which is that only Pakistan can get Pakistan right. It is not for the United States, and it's not for the world to prescribe what Pakistan can and should do. If Pakistan is to survive, and if it is to grow, and if it is to become a part of that critical region of the world which is probably going to be the engine of economic growth for Asia and perhaps the world in the future, then Pakistan must get it right. And that is, in fact, just to bring it to current events, the gist of the report that the Atlantic Council issued today, which is that Pakistan has the ability, and if given the right tools and the assistance for the long haul, and if a relationship is built between its friends across the globe and the people of Pakistan, and not with necessarily any single individual or entity or party, that you can have this kind of development and growth in Pakistan that we've all been talking about. In that context, the announcement by Senator Kerry this morning that he is putting together a new bill, which will no longer be the Biden-Lugar bill, but which he said within weeks will be presented to Congress for a long-term relationship of an enhanced partnership with Pakistan, is certainly good news, because it's the long-term relationships that matter. I think we, particularly in the Washington community, get too caught up in the short term, and we get caught up in the play-by-play, and we get caught up in the daily politics of who's up and who's down, and that detracts from looking at the long term and looking beyond and over the horizon to see what's possible. So just some of the pointers for our conversation and things that we can think about and talk about and perhaps continue this conversation over the next year or two as the new administration finds its feet. First of all, I think it'll be critical to see how the center-periphery relationships in Pakistan emerge, that instead of having a centrally controlled country dominated by either one party or one entity or one province, that there is a balance between the center and the provincial entities. And indeed, perhaps with the right kind of leadership, we can muster support for a subdivision of the current provinces from 4 to perhaps even 16 to create a much more balanced political entity, which has been the cause of much of the grief politically in Pakistan over its 62 years. Secondly, we have to look at civil-military relations, and we have to look at them in the long run, because the current imbalance in this, where the military, because it is the best organized institution in the country, does tend to dominate foreign policy as well as defense policy, and now increasingly the ideological discussions about what is the future of Pakistan. This really needs to be rebalanced in favor of civil society. And the military is the key to this change because at heart, most of these discussions are economic. And if the pie is going to shrink, then the military too will suffer like everybody else. And if they recognize that the pie has to increase, then the military will need to consider withdrawing from the economic sphere and letting the market forces take Pakistan where it truly belongs, among the leading, growing, developing economies of the world. We also have to look at the potential demographic shifts that have occurred and are occurring in Pakistan. There is a tremendous shift towards the urban centers. Pakistan already, once the new census figures come in, will probably be seen as a predominantly urban country with very large urban centers and mega cities, particularly Karachi, which has a greater population even today than half the countries of Europe. And this brings a very different kind of person onto the scene, particularly the political scene, because traditionally the inner cities have been the home of the conservative masses. That's where religion has often played a major role. And so we have to recognize that Pakistan is increasingly going to be a conservative state, with ritualistic form of religion playing a very large role, unless and until Pakistan changes its educational system and provides education on a much wider basis than is currently available. The good thing about the urbanization of Pakistan is that it might actually allow the emergence of urban politics. So when I look to the future as an optimist, I see the MQM at some point being a kind of a model without the cult aspect of it for other urban-based entities and urban-based parties that could form a coalition across the national landscape. And if it produces a true transnational leadership, which is not based on any single provincial political base, then Pakistan may have the basis for a stable polity emerging. We've talked of the media, and they play a great role, but they can also be a very disruptive force, particularly since the media in Pakistan are still very young, and the professionalism that is demanded in reporting and in carefully measuring what you're saying and reporting in not just news but also in analysis is sometimes lacking. I'm reminded of the immediate aftermath of the Mumbai attacks when one leading television channel sent out a roving correspondent and he was asking the most loaded question of people on the street, saying that India has challenged Pakistan, what is your response? And sure enough, he got the stereotypical responses. So you're creating a loop of ill-informed commentary, and by having the same 20 people go from one talk show to the next, you're creating a semblance of debate and discussion which is not well informed. I think that is a serious challenge for Pakistani media and Pakistani society. The India-Pakistan relationship needs to be looked at for the long run. It shouldn't be a chess game which is looking at your next move or the move after that. There needs to be a recognition that the future economic growth of both India and Pakistan and the other countries in the region depends on trade and commerce between these countries. And Economics 101 dictates that they should be each other's main trading partners. Once you establish these vested interest groups on both sides of the border between India and Pakistan, it'll become much harder for any government, whether it's civil or military, to create a conflict between these countries. In the long run, I think Pakistan needs to try and establish the pluralistic society that Muhammad Ali Jinnah thought of when he brought Pakistan into being. Pluralistic society that recognizes different religions and creeds, and that does not try and impose one sect or one ethnic group's views on another, so that it is no longer seen as a Punjabi-dominated country or dominated by any other language group or ethnic group, that it's seen as a country which relies on the rich mosaic of its component parts to succeed as a political entity, and which is truly blessed by a position on the globe where its geography is its destiny. It is not going to escape from that region, and it has to serve as a bridge between Central Asia and Western Asia and South Asia. So I will end on this note, that as we look at the future of Pakistan, we have to go back and look at Pakistan itself and see what kind of polity the Pakistanis want to create, rather than prescribe polities from outside. Thank you.
Panelists for their interventions. We have very little time to pursue this fascinating conversation, so we will take a couple of questions and then count on this group to continue the conversation, not just today, but beyond. And there's a gentleman in the back of the room who has his hand up.
My name is Faiz Rahman, and first I would like to thank the CSIS for taking the initiative to honor a colleague. We all miss him. He was a great journalist and a very good human being. And then Bob Hathaway, actually, he said a few things about turning the table, about addressing an issue from the American perspective. And that takes me to Steve Cohen's point about the drone attacks in the northern areas, in the Fatah. And he made a statement saying that these attacks have been quite effective with very minimum collateral damage. But I think there is a feeling that there is a significant collateral damage, not just in terms of human life, but in terms of American prestige and influence in the region.
Could you please get to the end of your question?
That brings me to the question. And the question is, America remains a very unpopular nation in Pakistan, and it's the other way around as well. Pakistan is one of the most unpopular nations in America. So how these two untrusting nations can work together, to address the issues that we have at hand? Thank you. And basically, any of you can answer this question.
I would simply refer you to the frequently difficult relationship the United States has with China. For a whole host of reasons, almost everybody in America is mad at China at one point or another. And yet the two countries, and similarly many Chinese, resent the United States for some of the same reasons that Pakistanis resent the United States. Yet the two nations rightly recognize that if they don't figure out a way to get along, both nations lose in that process. And I think the same type of relationship governs the United States and Pakistan. It's clearly in both our interests to find a way to work together. We're not going to always agree on all issues, but what we have to do is find a way to contain our disagreements so that they don't spill over and contaminate the entire relationship. The stakes are simply too important for both countries for us not to figure out a way to make this relationship work.
Gentleman at the back on this side.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Adnan Hassan, a former senior advisor at the World Bank and an investor now, actually, and investing in Pakistan. I'm from Pakistan. I was there on Saturday and talking to a bunch of young people, and I was stunned at the optimism and the commitment to entrepreneurship that they have, even in the current environment. Many of them, though not all of them, are expats who have studied and come back to Pakistan. They also came from countries in the Gulf where they've experienced the opportunities that are available to them. How much of the Kerry Lugar strategy goes to try to reach out to such young entrepreneurial pieces of Pakistan rather than, a top-down approach to spreading the opportunities?
Yeah, I think you make an excellent point. Unfortunately, right now, as the Kerry Lugar legislation stands, I don't think there's any specific initiatives to reach out to these young entrepreneurs that you talk about. But I think there is recognition that there are opportunities. For instance, I remember talking to the economic section at the embassy in Islamabad and talking about just that you know, there's a lot of innovation and opportunities out there that we just need to find and tap into. So while I don't think the legislation itself right now addresses this, it should be a core part of U.S. policy, and I think, you know, this is something that the U.S. should pursue, private-public partnerships possibly, looking at, you know, how to engage these communities. Were you in Karachi, did you say? Yeah. Okay. No, I think you're absolutely right. We are too often are focused at the strategic level and engaging with, you know, the senior officials who come and visit. But there has to be a way for Americans, you know, and the international community in general to reach out to this younger community. There's security issues right now for Americans, obviously, American officials. But if there was a way to foster, like I said, a public-private partnership, maybe getting Pakistani Americans like yourself involved in such initiatives, I think it's a great idea, and I think it's something that we need to focus more attention on. Thank you.
The previous administration was very interested in an idea called Reconstruction Opportunity Zones, which would have, had they been implemented, would have encouraged the development of light industry in the tribal areas and in the Northwest Frontier province. I don't know whether the new administration is still thinking in terms of ROZs, but to the extent it is, that clearly presents an opportunity for entrepreneurs such as the ones you were referring to.
If I could just add to that, we've got to reach out, and although one can make a strong case here for the potential for entrepreneurship, right now the first order of business is to convince the people of Pakistan that this partnership, there's something in it for them. At the moment, they don't see it that way. They see that American objectives and their own objectives have parted ways here. So in what we can do best here is simply to indicate that it's not just about terrorism and it's not just about supporting the president and the army, but that we can do things which are very tangible in changing, affecting their lives. That's a tall order, of course, but we've got to start back on that as quickly as possible.
Jim Moody, I was out in Pakistan with Marvin and was back recently as well up in the Northwest Frontier Province, where, again, the drone pump issue has been brought up many times here. It seems to me an embodiment of one of the problems we have. It's the measurable versus the unmeasurable. We can measure the bad guys we kill. We have no way of measuring the discontent, the anger, and the resentment that is caused by those policies. And we've got to – we talk about the militarization of Pakistan, the excessive military influence in the government of Pakistan towards its own people. I think we have an excessive militarization mentality when we deal with Pakistan. We treat it as a military problem so often rather than a social economic problem. You go to Pakistan and you sit in the Serena Hotel and you sit in the Marriott and you talk to that what was the one that just destroyed the Marriott? And that little thin slice of Pakistani society at the very top is a little bit like the French aristocracy on the eve of the revolution. They have no sense of what's going on in the village. You go out into the village and the Ministry of Education said there's a school here. You go to the village, there is no school. They call them ghost schools. But somebody's receiving a non-ghost check sitting in Pindi, not going to teach at the school. And until the U.S. policy begins to put pressure on those kind of issues, and the AID has no clue about that, I talked to them about it. 20% of children over 10 years old are not getting an education. If we don't come to grips with those kind of issues, I don't see how we're ever going to get progress. Thank you.
name is Durrani. I'm a local guy retired here originally from Pakistan. I have the same people who did the attack in Mumbai, similar people did it in Islamabad 2 months earlier. We didn't have such a big uproar about that, but we had a big uproar about the Mumbai thing, as if the government was behind it and so on. Is the present government administration doing something to encourage cooperation between the two governments? So if, God forbid, another similar thing happens in New Delhi, they don't say it's Pakistanis who are doing it. And the second thing that's similar is there are a lot of these organizations here, private NGOs in Pakistan, but there are a lot of associations here, Indians and Pakistanis. Why don't they get together sometimes and start talking to each other? Maybe it will reflect back home and they will also start talking to each other. Thank you.
I think there's no lack of encouragement in the U.S. for Indian and Pakistani communication and peacemaking. The most effective efforts of that sort, however, have been between Indians and Pakistanis without the U.S. involved. And my hope is that at some point the governments in both Islamabad and Delhi will be strong enough to pick up where they left off some months ago. And as far as the associations in the United States are concerned, Mr. Durrani, I think you can do more about that than we ever could. Yes.
Hi, my name is Dan Consolatore. I work for a small company called McKellar Corporation. I'm speaking for myself today. I'd like to pick up on some comments made by Mr. Nawaz, Marvin, and Steve Cohen. All three reference in one way or another the ethnic cleavages and the sort of alienation of populations from the center. A couple of you have actually used the terms, been brave enough to use the terms Punjabi and Pashtun, which for some reason it's a taboo subject. We don't really like to talk about it that much. My basic question is, isn't it? It's really common, and I'll ask you to respond to it. Isn't it clear that the basic problem from the American point of view and really as an issue of stability for Pakistan in general, right now the most pressing thing is the alienation of the Pashtun population? Isn't it clear that cultivating a relationship with that popular, with the population is really priority number one? In order to sort of enhance their embrace of Islamabad.
Yeah, let me see if I can respond to that. I agree with your comments. And in fact, a couple of months ago, the CSIS, we released a report on Fatah in which we recognized the fact that when you treat a part of the country as if it doesn't belong, and when you ignore the needs of the people of that part, then you're creating the situation which is ripe for militancy, and they become vulnerable to all kinds of other messages. That's exactly what's happened in Fatah, and that's exactly what's happening in contiguous parts in the settled areas and being reflected in the militancy in Swat. That's my hypothesis, because for 62 years we haven't invested in the people, we haven't invested in the region. In many ways, we've treated them very similar to how the United States treats the Indian reservations, sort of in an enclosed, self-contained cocoon, and we've pretended to ignore that they exist. And no wonder when the opportunity arises, they are willing to pick up arms fight for their rights. So that's the key to bring all the people of Pakistan into partnership, and rather than sit in Islamabad and pronounce on what's needed and what's right for the provinces. So it's a complete shift to what was the ideal of the Pakistani Federation, which was that the federating units would give power to the center rather than the other way around. That's the key if we're going to survive as a viable political entity.
I'm Jami Chandu. I'm a Reagan Fellow at National Endowment for Democracy. I have two brief comments about the Shuja's opinion and one question. You talked about the making more provinces in today's Pakistan, 16 provinces. I think breaking these provinces and making more provinces would be more disastrous in today's Pakistani situation. And the better solution would be to continue with these four provinces and giving more autonomy to them and to decentralize the state in real terms. And secondly, a brief comment that you talked that you quoted an example of MQM. I think Pakistan does not need anymore the urban terrorist parties like MQM. Pakistan really needs a secular and democratic and pro-people parties. So I think making more or developing more, encouraging more terrorist parties like MQM could not be a solution. And my question from any panelist, that I think the real pertinent problem in Pakistan is that the real transfer of power does not take place in Pakistan, no matter a political government is in office. For example, these days, apparently, a political government is in office. But I don't think, look at the role of the parliament, look at the role of the cabinet, look at the government. So I think the real transfer of authorities and powers, especially in defense-related matters, is an issue in Pakistan. And till the political governments, no matter they are weak, they are poor in performance, but the real transfer of authorities and powers to the political governments is really an issue in Pakistan.
I think we can agree to disagree on how many provinces or what the usefulness would be or not be. I was thinking of the Nigerian example, which did help solve a problem in Nigeria, a divide between north and south. It would create a much more balanced political entity, and we can talk offline about that. I don't think you fully heard what I said about the MQM. I said minus its cult approach. I was using it as a model of an urban-based political party, of which very few exist in Pakistan. That's really, that was really the key.